From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's happening again. U.S. soldiers in Iraq being left with second-rate equipment or none of what they really need. This time, it's upgraded body armor, the top-flight ceramic plates strong enough to keep increasingly lethal attacks from ripping open a soldier's chest, to keep that bullet from a young American's heart, lungs, vital organs, strong enough to let them live. While the country debates the war, the soldiers go without. There are many reasons, but it still ends up shocking. This hour On Point, a simple question. Why? We ask why. A superpower at war cannot put first-rate body armor on its soldiers. You can join the conversation. Why is the United States putting troops in the field with second-rate equipment? Why can't we, won't we, don't we deliver the body armor to the men and women fighting the war? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Michael Moss, investigative reporter for the New York Times. He's been writing about why the Pentagon has failed to procure enhanced body armor for American troops. Michael Moss, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure to be here, Tom.
You've been following this for a while. Explain to us what's going on. How can it be that there is body armor that could protect the troops in the field against the ratcheting up of firepower that they're facing, and yet they don't have it? What's happening here?
Well, the what answer is relatively simple to explain. What's happened is that, and this goes back more than a year now, the Pentagon quietly began buying a new type of ceramic plate that is inserted into the vests that American troops are wearing in Iraq that is more resistant to a higher level of threat that they're encountering in Iraq. They began this program last May of 2004, mm-hmm. and they're still in the process of acquiring these new plates.
And all that time later, troops are dying, and you know, it just strikes a nerve. I mean, we've seen the stories over the years now of armor not being there for the Humvees, of protective vests not being there or being defective when they get there, of soldiers having to write home for radios and ceramic plates, perhaps of the earlier vintage. What's the why here, Michael? Why can it take, how can it take so long for a superpower to get the best into the field to protect these soldiers?
Well, I think to understand what's going on here, our readers need to go back to 1993, actually, in Mogadishu, where the Somalian militia ambushed a number of U.S. Rangers who were on a peacekeeping mission there.
The Black Hawk Down story.
Yes, mm-hmm. Memorialized in the popular film Black Hawk Down. 17 U.S. Rangers died, but there's a general consensus that it could have been much worse had they not had a rather novel invention for American soldiers, which was a steel plate that they inserted into their vests.
So they had Kevlar vests already in those days?
They had a type of Kevlar vest that was sort of a relic from the Vietnam era, but this particular one was designed and made capable of having, you know, heavy plates inserted into the vest for added protection.
So Kevlar is just the beginning, and here the innovation was steel right. plates in addition. Okay.
Correct. The vests we remember from Vietnam were flak resistant, mm-hmm. couldn't stop bullets. With the addition of the plate, it was meant to be not bulletproof, mind you, but have an increased capability against munitions.
I want to be sure I understand when you say flak resistant, that's sort of shrapnel flying here and there.
Exactly.
But
right.
not a direct bullet. With the steel plates, were they able to resist some bullets?
Well, they were. You can even see it in the movie. If readers want to rent it again and refresh their minds, I mean, there are scenes where the bullets are actually pinging off of the plates, and guys are maybe will get knocked down with a bruise, but they're getting back on their feet and returning fire. The one problem with those plates was that they were steel, they were heavy steel, mm-hmm. and even these robust, brawny Rangers were reluctant to put on the steel. There was one officer, I remember in particular, who decided only to wear one steel plate in his front and not his back on the notion that he wouldn't be running from anybody. He was shot and killed in the back.
But this is 1993, so
yep.
we knew more than a decade ago how important this kind of enhancement to the Kevlar vest could be. And then
right.
we come to the war in Iraq, and it's 10 months before soldiers there even have the plates in their vests to start with.
So what happened was after 1993 that the Pentagon was inspired to develop a lighter plate that could be worn by your average soldier who may be going on long marches and need to wear the plate for a longer period of time. So there was a research and development program that was put underway, and lo and behold, they came up with a ceramic, a specialized ceramic plate that really is, when you look at it, is a miracle of invention. The New York Times bought me a set of body armor, and I was looking at it last night, and, you know, small plate weighing 4.5 pounds can stop bullets, and fairly heavy bullets, and it's only 4 pounds, and you can put it into your vest and wear that.
So that was terrific, but it took a heck of a long time for that to get to all the soldiers in Iraq.
That was terrific, but then we come to Iraq, of course, in 2003, and the huge miscalculation that the Pentagon did, which was to underestimate the resolve and the skill of the insurgency. So when they went into Iraq in March 2003, they went into it with the idea that they only needed to provide these new plates to soldiers on the front lines, quote-unquote. And what they discovered, of course, very quickly is that there are no front lines in Iraq. Soldiers in the backfield were getting killed who had only the vest and not the plate to be inserted. So, huge scramble. They go to American industry and say, we need tens of thousands of these ceramic plates overnight. And guess what? There is no American industry. There is one vendor making these plates for the Pentagon at the time because we just come out of 10 years of relative peace time.
Superpower, quote-unquote. The capacity wasn't there.
Exactly. And what you have, the problem they suddenly realize then is that, you know, they're relying on an industry that goes through these incredible boom-bust cycles. Bust during peacetime, boom during wartime, and it's taking them incredible amounts of time to gear up and ramp up to meet the overnight demands that are put upon them.
That they might have anticipated, but never mind that. Michael Moss, what you point out is now the firepower has ratcheted up, and we know we're not talking about whole total protection here. This is mainly against bullets, not against the bombs that just killed four more soldiers today. But, you know, every piece of this is kind of infuriating in its own way. If it will stop bullets, let's have them have it. The bullets are getting, the caliber is getting heavier that's being used against U.S. troops. These more advanced plates could stop those, and now they're not getting those.
Well, it's very frustrating to soldiers. After our story ran on Sunday, I got notes from logistics officers in the field in Iraq who had not heard one word about this new plate and were asking me, you know, a near reporter, for information about the plates, where they could be obtained, etc.
Where does it stand right now? How many soldiers have them? How many don't? How long is it going to be before we offer this top flight protection to everybody? Because as you imply, the front lines are essentially everywhere now in Iraq.
We had a number of high-level meetings with generals at the Pentagon who initially wanted to ask us to not run the story we did on Sunday for fear that it would encourage the insurgency to attack soldiers on foot in a greater manner than they are attacking soldiers in vehicles.
Because they read the news reports, too, and you didn't want to give away what kind of bullets this wouldn't stop, and you did not publish that part of the information.
Ultimately, we agreed and came to an agreement with the Pentagon that we would, in fact, run a story but would refrain from mentioning the specific munitions that are at issue here. However, the Pentagon refused to tell us exactly how many plates they've managed to get over to Iraq already and just when this program will be finished. All we will say that it will be at least several months before they'll complete the job.
And meanwhile, the death count goes on. It's partly industrial capacity, but for heaven's sakes, couldn't we reach out to Japan or someplace where they've got more capacity? And second, Michael, what about the procurement process itself? Are they really cutting through all the red tape here and just getting it done?
Well, one of the very strange things with the situation is that what the Pentagon has done in this case is gone out to the industry with specifications for what the plate should do, and it's up to every company, every little armor company that's now making the plates, and there are four on contract now with two more coming online. It's up to them to actually design the plate, and they're all doing so independently in their own way and then subjecting it to testing. That's one of the reasons why this is taking so long is that the wheel is being reinvented by each of these small companies over and over again. So there's no coherent sort of national, you know, combined effort to get these plates met. And the plates are not uniform either. Every plate is different. And while they may meet the specifications that the Pentagon has put out, they are, in fact, different materials, different designs, different crafting.
And meanwhile, the bullets fly and the soldiers die. Michael Moss, we're very grateful for your reporting on this. Grateful to you for joining us this hour. Thank you for being with us.
My pleasure, Tom.
Joining us now from Washington, Lawrence Korb. He was Assistant Secretary of Defense for, among other things, manpower and logistics under President Ronald Reagan from 1981 to 1985. He's now a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Lawrence Korb, thanks for being with us.
Nice to be with you, Tom.
You know, it just makes the hair stand up on your neck when you hear these stories sometimes. I mean, we're debating this war at home, but soldiers are dying there. How can it be that a superpower can't supply even this number of soldiers with the latest technology with the best protection?
Well, I can explain it, not defend it. They did not think that we'd be in Iraq that long. They underestimated the insurgency. They thought we'd be greeted as liberators. And as Michael said, they only gave the ceramic vest to the frontline troops. Then they refused to make it a priority. I mean, if you take a look at what they're doing here with the body armor as well as the armor for the vehicles, the Humvees, you get the sense it's business as usual. Well, you know, it takes a while. We have to do this. We have to do that.
Don't have the armor. Be patient. We're working on it. Go back out there and fight.
I think what you need to do is a Secretary of Defense or the President has to say, look, this is important. We're going to get it done. I don't care where you get it done. And, you know, I'll get Congress. I'll invoke emergency authority or whatever it is. But it's going to happen and happen quickly.
We remember stories of LBJ banging the table, calling the secretaries of this and that in the middle of the night saying, is it happening? Do you feel that kind of urgency here, Lawrence Corp?
No, you don't. You see as business as usual. And, you know, when Paul Wolfowitz was the Deputy Secretary of Defense, this is really the Chief Operating Officer, because the Secretary is off, you know, having to travel around the world and do a lot of other things. You got the impression he was traveling around the world, too, so nobody was really in charge. I mean, this is a job that was once held by people like David Packard, and I can't imagine David Packard just sitting there with something like this happening dealing with the problem.
Lawrence Corp, stand by. It's an infuriating, incredible story. We're trying to figure it out. We're talking about why tens of thousands of American troops in Iraq don't have the body armor that will protect them. Why is America putting troops in the field with second-rate equipment? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking this hour about why tens of thousands of American troops in Iraq do not have the body armor that will protect them, and why U.S. soldiers from the early days of this war have been left short of critical supplies. You can join the conversation. How can we have yellow ribbons on our cars and second-rate armor on our soldiers' bodies in Iraq and Afghanistan? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We asked the Defense Department, the Army, the Marines to come on and explain this for us. They all declined to speak to this issue on air. But we do have with us former Assistant Secretary of Defense Lawrence Corb. He's now Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress. And from Washington, Christian Lowe, Staff Writer for the Marine Corps Times. Christian Lowe, thanks for being with us this morning.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Christian, we know this is complicated. We know this is high tech. We don't just want to beat up on people who are trying their best, and yet, you know, you can feel the whole country's frustration when the troops in the field don't have the best of what's going on. To get a sense of how this world works, before we turn to these upgraded ceramic plates, I wish you'd tell us something about the story that you uncovered in May of this year, 8-month investigation. You revealed that the Marine Corps had issued 10,000 troops defective vests with life-threatening flaws. Give us a sense of that incident to give us some perspective here, Christian. What happened there?
Well, Tom, what I found was that late in 2003 and in 2004, when the Marine Corps was gearing up for its second sort of rotation of troops to do the security operations over there,
right?
The vests that they were acquiring from a company called Point Blank Body Armor, which is based down in Florida, their quality was declining. They were exhibiting some penetrations that they shouldn't have from 9mm pistol bullets, and some deep indentations in the Kevlar fabric that gave program engineers pause.
And pause, to say the least. I mean, you had people just up in arms about the quality issues here. People saying, don't send these vests out.
Right. They were pretty upset about it, wanted to get to the bottom of it. The Marine Corps was facing great pressure to get these fielded, and issued a series of waivers acknowledging the flaws, but nevertheless fielding them.
So the vests went out, but they went out in such a way that they couldn't even be called. They didn't know where they went. They didn't know who was wearing them ultimately.
Somewhat true. They did know who had them. The problem was the serial numbers are handwritten on the inside of the vest. And actually, the ballistic panels that are made out of Kevlar are inserted into the camouflage outer vest that you see, and they get chafed and rubbed inside as the Marine wears it, and basically those numbers wear off, and you're unable to really tell which one is which.
You had technical advisors to the Marines, one, James Makowitz, at the Army Soldier Systems Center in Natick, Massachusetts, saying there were major performance and quality assurance problems with Point Blank's products here. He ultimately recommending disciplinary action against the contractor to resolve the issue. Did that happen, Christian Lowe?
No, and ironically, shortly after that, the Army signed a contract with the company to purchase 360,000 vests to the tune of $190 million. And we later found out that one of the vests that the company had submitted for tests to win the contract actually failed, and it was the design that the Marine Corps were using. Nevertheless, the Army signed a contract with that company.
$190 million contract for a company that had left 10,000 Marines in the field with defective vests, essentially.
That's essentially what happened, though. The Marine Corps argues that two things. One, they argue that it's the vests are better than the previous vest that Mike sort of talked with you a little bit about, the flak jackets that really don't protect against 9mm bullets.
So it's better than Vietnam-era vests, but we would kind of expect that in 2003, 4, 5.
That's right. They argue that, and they also say that they took samples from those production lots to an outside test facility, a private company called H.P. White, and they passed there. So they made the technical determination on their own to field these vests.
Well, that's great, but of course their in-house specialists in this were the ones who said don't send them, and they had to sign a special waiver to get it done. Christian Lowe, we're going to turn to you on the upgraded body armor front for a moment. Larry Korb, is this just another example of Donald Rumsfeld's philosophy, you go to war with the army you have? Are you sympathetic to the Marine Corps officers who signed the waivers to put those defective vests into the field, or should we be scandalized by that?
Well, you can understand why they were willing to do it, because the question was, do they do that or send them there with nothing and send them with the old flak jackets? But, again, it goes back to the point I made. Nobody anticipated we'd go there. I mean, the Marines went and left. They did not know they were going back because nobody thought that the occupation would last this long. And that was your fundamental flaw to begin with. And remember, this was a war of choice. We didn't have to go to war when we did. Mm. We could have waited. And, we could have dealt with a lot of these problems in the run-up. The administration knew they were going into Iraq sometime in 2001. So they had 2 years to take care of these things, but they really just, because of the way that they had planned for it, didn't do anything, and then they've been playing catch-up ball ever since. It took them 10 months after the invasion to give the the troops in Iraq, all the army troops in Iraq, to give them the ceramic plates.
And now we're moving in on 2,000 dead and thousands wounded. Christian Lowe, we want to hear more about this the latest armor issue, but I want to bring our callers into this conversation at the same time. Frank is calling from Dubuque, Iowa. Hi, Frank. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Enjoy your show. I really appreciate your forum. You're a great listener, and it's a refreshing show to hear versus the Rush Limbaugh, the alleged liberal media, what I call fascist media of close-minded politics.
We're trying to listen very closely. What do you hear in this story, Frank?
You're awesome. And I got a very simple, or not simple solution, but very simple answer for you. You may take it as very caustic, but I honestly believe it. And that is the answer to why this is happening.
Yep.
And the question is quite simple. The American public, let me rephrase that. The majority of the American public does not care. Because if they really cared, they would finance this. So about my father's generation, World War II generation, had excise taxes, rubber taxes, rationing for the war.
You know what, Frank? I want to challenge you on that. I don't believe that's true. I don't believe the majority of Americans don't care about those soldiers over there.
No, I'm not saying that. They don't
care.
That's
what you said. You said they don't care.
Well, why wouldn't they finance it? Remember the guy that talked about the body armor to Rumsfeld?
Yeah,
and they tried to say, oh, well,
National Guard Private Thomas Wilson stood up in Kuwait and said, where's the army for our armor for our Humvees?
And their answer was some liberal reporter put him up to it to cause problems, anti-patriotic. These guys are about as unpatriotic as they come. To put these poor young men and women in this position without proper armor is appalling. But see, what people want, sanitized news. They don't want to hear about what's really going on and how many people are. They just want to have a tax cut and feel good about that, slap a sticker on their car and get in their Humvee and take off.
You know, you may be right, but I have a feeling that there's something missing in this picture, because I believe that Americans do want those young men and women protected. Lawrence Corbett, is there a missing link here between the obvious concern we see among the public at one level for these troops and what's actually happening in the field? Where does it fall down?
Well, as things go in the Pentagon, this is not a big money issue. We're talking about $160 million to give them this enhanced plate. I mean, it's costing us, you know, $5 or $6 billion a month over there. But I think Frank has this point in the sense that we're outraged that people are, but they're not doing anything about it. You know, that they're not demanding, you know, that Rumsfeld be fired. I mean, you know, for his statement back there in 2004, late 2004, when the National Guard soldier talked about hillbilly armor and
right.
saying, well, you go to war with the army you have, not if you like, rather than trying to explain what was going on and say he would do something about it. And I think that's the attitude that in World War II, I think, would have gotten Roosevelt or Truman to fire somebody.
So somehow people getting a free pass here, even as hearts go out all over the country to those soldiers. Some kind of missing link here. I mean, there is a rising tide of complaint about this. I'm looking here at a release from Congressman John Larson of Connecticut just a couple days ago. He says, these delays are a disgrace. The administration has repeatedly lapsed in its duty to provide the men and women it sends into war with the best equipment possible after 2 years and with all the appropriate funding levels. An investigation needs to be done into why this hasn't been done. Christian Lowe, we're sure this is not simple. This is very high tech we're talking about here. What's going on at the manufacturing level that is keeping these high tech ceramic plates from being in those vests right now?
I think, Tom, it's more than just a manufacturing issue. And I want to correct I don't know, give another perspective.
We want to hear it. We want to hear it.
This isn't second-rate armor. The armor that's over there in Iraq and Afghanistan is some of the best armor available in the world.
Is it the best we've got?
Is
it stopping the bullets that insurgents are using now to kill U.S. troops?
The vast majority, yes. But there are some threats out there that and Mike and I actually have been pursuing the same story,
right.
And we both were confronting the same issues with the Pentagon, pleading with us not to reveal what some of these threats are.
Okay,
so
we want to be reasonable. We want to be reasonable. So
right.
Let's hear it.
But this is it's a threat that is not seen often, but is seen. And these enhanced plates, have been available for a long time, actually. And special operations forces use them because they're going after targets, insurgent targets that usually have a higher tech kind of defense.
Right, and we've seen the video on that. When they're hit right in the chest with these plates in Afghanistan,
yep.
Fall down by a big bullet, fall down, stand
right.
up, and take cover, and thank heavens for that. But why aren't they in all the pockets?
Because they're heavy. They're about a pound heavier. And I wear body armor. I've been to Iraq. I've been to Afghanistan twice. You know, we wear these when we go on patrols with the soldiers and Marines and stuff. And I wear the exact same body armor that the troops wear over there. And it's heavy and bulky and cumbersome and not that pleasant to wear.
I know it's
like
heavy,
that.
But that is not all we're reading here. I mean, we're reading about sort of cottage industry level manufacturers who can't churn it out in time for the soldiers who are going into a situation where they'd take that weight and be happy for it.
That is part of the issue, yes. And these companies, especially the one that I investigated with the vest issue, Point Blank Body Armor. I mean, these companies have expanded rapidly, and these components are made by hand to exacting standards, and churning out this many, you're inevitably, I guess, going to have some flawed components.
I want to bring another voice in here. Joining us from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, is David Warner. He's president of Survival Consultants International. He's worked in the executive protection field since 1991, studied ballistics for the past 15 years. David Warner, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, Tom. How are you today?
We're great, but we're not happy about the reports we're getting from the field about American troops not having the best protection. We sit back here debating the war. They're out there fighting it. Christian Lowe points out these things are heavy, and we know soldiers don't like to carry anything heavier than they need to, but yet they want to live. Why aren't these plates more widely available? Why aren't we churning them out fast enough to get them to troops who want and need them, David Warner?
Well, there are several possibilities for why that would be. One of the first things that comes to my mind, keeping in mind that these inserts are made of silicon carbide and boron carbide, is that the initially supplied materials to the manufacturer that Christian has denoted may not be sufficient or up to standard before they're even received by somebody who is manufacturing the plates.
And we're reading that these really key, super high-tech ingredients, they're having trouble even getting a hold of them, producing enough.
Correct. So, first of all, if you have a short side on that, and then you have to understand, in other words, it's a complicated process to make this, but I can make it very easy to understand. And I think that might be helpful. When you take the silicon carbide and boron carbide elements,
yep,
you put them through heating, cooling, chemical, and material and then bonding processes,
mm-hmm,
what happens between the silicon carbide and the boron carbide as they cool at different rates, and basically what happens is you can end up with a shrinking at different time frames or levels.
Is it good or bad?
With an interfacial fracturing or stress.
And that creates problems, that creates imperfect plates? Okay, let me ask you this. Japan has done very high-level work in ceramics. Could this be better produced by Kyocera or someone in Japan? Are we keeping it home and by that not getting it out to the troops?
Well, first of all, I would absolutely not want to see any of our weapons nor any of our armor manufactured outside of the United States.
Well, how do you keep that up in a globalized period when some of the best manufacturing is no longer here? Does that mean troops have to die so that we can try and, you know, slowly create the industry here?
Absolutely not. I mean, if it came to that, then of course I would have to side with you on that. However, I do believe that the problem is fixable, but if you realize that the exacting specifications for creating these things has to do with extremely high temperatures, and then in the cooling process, you can have these shearing effects take place because you're dealing with chemical, mechanical, and kinetic processes.
And I know you've got a process that might work without that high temperature. You think it would be better. Meanwhile, the soldiers don't have it. I want to get a call. Nancy's calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Nancy. You're on the air.
Hi. I want to thank you all for allowing me to voice my concerns. My daughter's in the military.
Yes.
She's in the Army.
Where is she posted?
Well, ironically, she's in Hawaii.
Oh,
and I say to her, before you go to hell, they send you to paradise. She's prepared to die. She has already made arrangements for us to take care of the money that she will receive, or rather, we will receive in the case she goes to Iraq. And I told her, the furniture you want us to buy and the house you want us to buy, we will not buy. We will build you a place in honor, a crypt. Probably a tomb.
Nancy, is your daughter confident that she'll get the best equipment when she goes?
She is not. She's very concerned about all of the troops, all of her comrades are going to die with the cheap Walmart-type items manufactured for them. This is ridiculous. Ms. Shaheen, I honor you. Please continue fighting because we women do not start wars. Men, it sounds to me, have taken control of our children for the purpose of fighting their little boys' wars. Please stop.
Nancy, we've got to go to a break, but we hear you. I'm so glad you called. I wish your daughter the best of luck, and our hopes go with you and with her. Thank you for calling. Lawrence Korb, it's hard to hear anything less than first-rate stuff in the field, but we're also hearing a caution here. Some of this is very high-tech. We just have to live with this. This is the price of war.
Well, again, there's no doubt about when if you don't plan well, then you're going to have to play catch-up ball, and they never assumed that they'd have this many troops in there this long. Had they decided in 2001, look, we better, you know, do what we need to do just in case, you wouldn't be in as bad shape as you are now. And that, to me, is the real problem. Or once having discovered it, put high-level attention, including the president, to speed this up.
We hear that. We've got to take a break here. David Warner at Survival Consultants International, thank you for joining us. We're talking about why American troops do not have the body armor that will best protect them. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about why American troops in Iraq do not have the top-grade body armor that will protect them. You can join the conversation. Why have parents had to include body armor in care packages to their kids at war? Where is the table-pounding leadership from the White House on this? Have you followed the string of shortages that have plagued U.S. troops in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and veterans, troop families? What have you seen? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, joined in this hour by Christian Lowe. He's a staff writer for the Marine Corps Times. He's done some real groundbreaking investigative work on the issue of troop protection. Also by Lawrence Korb, former Assistant Secretary of Defense, now Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress. Right now, Joseph is calling from Chesterfield, South Carolina. Hi, Joseph, you're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I think it's important that you get some opinions from some callers that actually have experience with this situation.
Let's hear it.
I enlisted in the Army in 1986 when the USSR was our biggest adversary,
mm-hmm.
and volunteered for the 82nd Airborne Division in an infantry company.
Okay.
When we got there, we had Jeeps with no tops on them, no doors, some older weapons, and we took what we had and we made the best of it. In 1989, we jumped into Panama to capture Manuel Noriega. My unit was in the leading expeditionary force. When we got there in the 82nd, you can't carry everything in the world.
Right.
You can't carry what you think you'll need.
Mm-hmm.
And we were very proud of the fact that we commandeered local vehicles and turned them into improvised home and personnel carriers.
So you've got to improvise in the field.
Exactly. I mean, the United States provides the soldiers with the best that we got. And compared to any other army in the world, we're top notch. You can only armor an individual soldier, and I know from experience as an infantryman, to a certain extent. If you get him too heavy and make him bulletproof, then he's a sitting target.
But when the troops want it and it's avail, it's technically available, right now we're not giving those troops the best we've got. Are you saying that's okay, that's just the way war is?
Well, I'm saying mobility is just as important as protection, because mobility is a form of protection. It's called cover and concealment.
Right.
It's a hard thing to say, and their guys are getting killed, and I've got friends that are still in the military. I got out after my 4 years, and I went to the first Desert Storm
mm-hmm.
as a part of the Ready Reserve.
Mm-hmm.
Volunteered to go back. The problem is, individual soldiers, you have some that's going to want the world and some that's going to be make the best of what they got. And it's going to all come down to your individual responsibility. And a lot of these soldiers nowadays joined up for the benefits and never took their time to stand back and think what would happen if they actually had to go fight.
So get out there and do the best with what you've got. And we've heard this. We've heard, and we understand that's part of war. Joseph, we thank you for reminding us of that. Donald Rumsfeld has said this to the country repeatedly. And yes, soldiers don't want to carry more than they've got to carry, yet we hear that soldiers also want this armor, and they can't necessarily get it when they want it. Barack is calling from Boston. Hi, Barack. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
I'm sorry, I can't think. Yeah. Hello.
Barack, speak to us.
Fine. I was a Marine, and I was a Marine, and I'm telling you, the attitude of the Marine Corps towards this armor is not what you would be expecting. I mean, the Marines believe that when you die in a war, you die because you have no discipline. You die because you didn't follow what you're supposed to follow properly, you know.
So they're taught not to rely on equipment, but to take responsibility and not feel like they have to have it.
Right. And the mission of the Marine Corps, the primary objective of the Marine Corps is mission accomplishment. And before they go to war, they ensure that they have everything they need. In other words, they don't go to any war unless they're certain that they do have what they need. And when they do go to war, they do not believe that you would die because of Hamas. No.
But we're seeing repeatedly in this war, Barack, that they haven't had exactly what they need. They don't have all the even radios and vests without defects. Are you saying that they've got the right attitude here, just go with what you've got, or should they be?
Right. They just can't see any reason why you would die because of an armor or because your armor is not good. No. People would die because of what kind of a Marine you are.
Do you agree, Barack? You've been a Marine. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I was.
Do you agree with that perspective?
I have a mixed feeling with that perspective, honestly. Sometimes that perspective is true, sometimes maybe not. But I'm just telling you the general attitude of the Marine Corps. If you go to the Marine Corps and ask them, well, how would this be done, or how would you solve this problem? They wouldn't say armor. They need an
right.
armor.
Right. We've got it, Barack. We appreciate that firsthand perspective there, and we thank you for your call. Lawrence Korb, we want to get our emotions, you know, pitched correctly here, soberly. We know that American soldiers will take an awful lot on their individual shoulders. They will take responsibility, whether or not they've got the best equipment. Should we be asking them to do that to the extent they've been asked in Iraq?
No, you shouldn't ask them to go in without the equipment that they should have. And I was, General Cato, who's the head of the Marine Corps Systems Command, he said he's not happy about the delay to replace the armor. So I don't think he wants to see the troops go in there without what they should have. Obviously, if it's an emergency and you get it like in World War II. We sent a lot of people into battle that really weren't as prepared or armed or equipped as they should have been, but we had no choice because we were attacked and Germany declared war on us. This is a little bit different. This was a war of choice. You had time to plan for it, and you should have planned better. And then when you saw that it did not turn out to be what you thought, you should have given, more high-level attention to the issues rather than taking what I would say is Rumsfeld's cavalier attitude toward it.
Let's get another call. Jay is calling from Salem, New Hampshire. Hi, Jay. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a retired Marine intelligence officer, and I've also spent time in combat arms. But my feelings towards this go to perception of guns and butter. You know, during the Second World War, be it one that it wasn't a war of choice, we were able to gear up from a standing start with insufficiency to overcome on a global scale those threats that we were facing. Stinger went from making sewing machines to turning out machine guns. Other
right.
manufacturers did similar things.
Right across the board.
Right across the board, and there's no total involvement. We're at a point now where we were similarly in Vietnam where the people at home, really, other than those who have persons directly involved in what's going on, are going about their daily business as if there's no particular care. You know, they're going shopping, they're going to movies, they're doing whatever.
No national mobilization here.
That's right. And there, without that lack, or there is a lack of buy-in in that regard, but without that, there is no demonstrated ability of this nation to go that way.
Jay, you've been in the Marines. You sound like a smart guy. Let me ask you, do you think it's possible? I mean, the president reminds us we are the superpower, but is it possible that our manufacturing base has simply been hollowed out or globalized in a way that when the rubber meets the road, we don't have the factories that can do this? I mean, these are little tiny companies being started in Florida and Arizona to churn out body armor that they could use in Iraq right now.
Well, in many regards, that's probably very true. I mean, we're down to one company that's manufacturing small arms ammunition for, all of the military and all its needs. You know, to try to gear up to the level that we were at World War II, given the industrial base that we presently have, because it's been dispersed on a global nature, it would be very difficult for us to do. But at the same time, that doesn't mean there isn't an ability out there that some closely akin type of manufacturing capability couldn't be switched. You know, maybe they forego the profit margins they would be manufacturing backpacks for back to school. And
right, but bang the table, put the resources there, put the heat on, and get it done. And Jay, we hear that, and we thank you for your call. I want to turn next to Florence, South Carolina. We've got Harry calling there. Hi, Harry, you're on the air.
Hey, the last caller seems like was kind of getting the conversation back toward, I think, where you were trying to go. You know, it's nice to get the opinion of people that were soldiers and parents of that.
But, yes, it is.
And I believe that your point was kind of on the political and industrial aspect of,
yes,
of this issue. I have a little company now that makes military support equipment, and I spent 15 years in the Army.
Do you make armor, Harry? Do you make body armor?
No, we don't. We don't. We make shelters for the back of the new generation of flatbed vehicles, and they are armored.
Okay.
But you know, that's not the kind of thing that you're going to tote around.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of this issue is, like, say, political industrial. Number one, it's political. You have the one guest that's saying they should have planned better. It's not a 3-year fix. It's a 10-year fix. It's an issue that needed to be addressed to be ready now because of the way the military procurement systems and fieldings work.
So why is that a political issue and not an industrial procurement issue, Harry?
Well, it's a political issue because the President of the United States says, get this fixed, and local and federal politicians have to be involved. But those are elected people, and the procurement system is run pretty much by a bureaucracy, much like the State Department you always hear in D.C. The
right.
State Department doesn't care who's president because he rents that house, they live there.
Right.
The procurement system tends to be very much that same way. Nothing moves quickly. To counterbalance that argument, nothing moves quickly because the military is about projecting political will, breaking things, killing people, unfortunately. So there are very, very tight controls on what is done. And
it can take a long, long time. Harry, our time's ticking down here, and I want to take that point up with Christian Lowe from the Marine Corps Times. Christian, what about the procurement system? We've heard some fairly bitter complaints about it during this deployment in Iraq. There have been efforts to try and create avenues that cut through the bureaucracy there. Is it working? Is it working in this case?
I think in many cases it is, actually, and with the body armor industry is a good example of that. You know, the Army has obviously more troops to armor, and it has been working over the last 5 years to refine its body armor. I mean, I think they have almost a half dozen different formulas. Some have worked, some have not. They've been trying to reduce the weight. They've been trying to increase ballistic protection with a lot of different models. And you are seeing, and I do cover a lot of procurement issues for our newspapers, you are seeing a lot of stepping around that old bureaucracy that Harry was talking about. In fact, his example is a perfect one, a small company down in Florida addressing a problem of armoring the back of trucks. There's a lot of that going on, and I think, you know, and there is an argument to be made that sidestepping some of these procurement bureaucratic hurdles may end up giving you a product that doesn't work quite like you expected it to. There's a reason why they do all these tests, and there's a reason why they go through this procurement process and have milestones and that sort of thing. One wonders if some of the gear that the troops are using now, 5 years or 10 years hence, will really be working properly.
You mean whether it will or won't?
Exactly.
Still, and how can we live with it? You'd think we'd marshal it, as our caller said, marshal those resources so that it's done as well as can be, as quickly as can be. Ed is calling from Niagara Falls in New York. Hi, Ed. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
We're good, thanks. What do you think?
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
I just want to make a couple quick comments. Firstly, I listened to your program yesterday on truth. And
yes, sir.
I just want to say that the administration and some people associated with it today are such professional liars that they have you and I running around questioning whether or not we actually know what the truth is.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to...
But we're on armor now. What do you think about it?
I'm a toolmaker, and I was involved in building some of the original molds of where back in the 60s.
Molds for what?
For the armor, for the Vietnam conflict.
Yeah.
And I worked with KCT Southern Carbide. I've used machine tools to grind it. I've been involved in some of the process where they actually manufacture it.
So why aren't we getting it done better and faster?
You're not getting it done better and faster. Carborundum doesn't even exist here in this city anymore. You go up into New England states and things like that where Norton and some of the other people were involved in that.
Yep.
The stuff, it's been outsourced.
The sort of hollowed out machine tool industry.
Our entire concept of protection for our country has been outsourced.
And it makes you wonder what superpower means once that has happened. Ed, we appreciate your point and your firsthand experience there. I want to get one more caller while we can. Thanks for calling in from Niagara Falls. Deke is calling from Portland, Oregon. Hi, Deke. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Sure,
Tom,
sure.
I hate to say this, but honestly, I think this is a class issue.
What do you mean?
These are poor kids who are being sent to war, and these are not the sons of investment bankers, congressmen, lawyers, upper-class families. These are poor kids, and I honestly don't think that this administration cares.
So you're saying maybe people care, but it's kind of hypothetical caring because the people in power, it's not their kids?
It's not their kids, and there's a very good piece in the New York Times on just this point today. And I think that it's sad to say, but I think the current populace, you know, they don't know anybody who's been killed.
So, which populace? I mean, these are American families all over the country who are sending their sons and daughters.
But the people who are not getting the job done are the people in power, and they are not their kids.
Deke, we've got it. It's a good point. We thank you for making it. Lawrence Korb, we understand your refrain throughout this hour that the planning could have been better, should have been better, should have been done. But is there also something here to learn about what kind of superpower this country is and is not these days? Do we, you know, we talk big, but do we have the capacity to really deliver on the ground?
Well, I think you talked about globalization, and you have to look at it as a worldwide market. And I would not, again, I would waive whatever, you know, Buy American provision you had and get this wherever you could when you need it. And this is right. I mean, the whole nature of defense industry and the industrial base and everything has changed. So you need to factor that in when you make this, when you decide where you're going to get this stuff and how you're going to get it.
Christian Lowe, we've heard about what's been hollowed out here. We know there's still capacity in small countries, companies who are working on this. Could it be done faster, better, if we looked abroad or not?
I really don't know the answer to that. I can see some hurdles to doing that, though. The quality assurance testing and verification that would need to be done typically is done at the manufacturing plant. I don't know how that would work if you were building vests and plates in Japan and you had a defense contract management agency official there doing the QA.
They're an ally. They've got a pretty good quality record in Japan. I mean, you hate to say send it there, but on the other hand, you want people to have the best. You want them to have it as quickly as they can get it.
Right. Again, that speaks to the issue of whether the if you're talking about the SAPI plates, enhanced SAPI plates,
right,
whether that's a question really of industrial base, whether it's a question of the specialized material that goes on the back of that boron carbide plate called Dyneema or SpectraShield. There's a shortage of that. Honeywell makes SpectraShield.
Right.
And in fact, Dyneema is made by a Dutch company. So there's your globalization right there. Whether it's an industrial capacity or a manufacturing capacity, I don't know that that's necessarily the case. I think that from what I've reported is there wasn't deemed the need for these kinds of plates for everyone until now.
Easy to say if you're not on the front line, and the front line is everywhere in Iraq. Christian Lowe with the Marine Corps Times. We're very grateful to you for being with us. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And Lawrence Korb, former Assistant Secretary of Defense, now Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress. Larry, thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Nice to be with you, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.